businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 172 of the Killing It Podcast. I'm Carl, joined today by Dave and Ryan, as always. And I have to apologize for the use of the word bullshit, but, you know, taking a tip from Monty Python, it only appears once in this episode, so you're past it now.
you have survived the moment of cursing. Gents, I'm going to ask a question today. What's the longest or most complex thing you have memorized?
So I have memorized a bit of something from when I was a camp counselor. It is literally the most useless thing I know. And it is, it and didn't little kitten, oat and don't and little boat, nip, skiddly, oat and don't and bodo, skiddy and dat and wad, and chew, which I can repeat endlessly and teach you how to do. But it now occupies permanent space in my long-term memory, and it will be there forever.
See, that is deep, long-term memory memorization. I do not recall any of the things, honestly, that I memorized like that. AP English class, senior year of high school, it was given to us as a challenge to memorize. There were several things you could choose from, but the introduction to the Epic of Gilgamesh was one of the options, and it was worth a very sizable amount of stuff when you were actually comparing whether you could just gaff off and not pay attention to a test that you were about to take. It would replace one of those, and it was a great deal of freedom and pride. I legit do not remember a single word.
But if somebody started, you might be able to finish a few stands.
Yeah, you would unlock a certain part of my gray matter, and I would have a little glitch for a second, and then I would be right back.
Right. I mean, like there's things, like I wanted to say, like, by default, I might go, like, well, I learned the Lord's Prayer as a kid, but I'm not sure I could do that right now. I know the Pledge of Allegiance, right, for the U.S. Like, that's a long passage. I could do that one right now. I know all the words to the Star Spangled Banner, right? So I think that's a little longer. I will freely admit I have a memory like a sieve. Like, it does not generally keep specific things like that. I'm really good with locations and visualization, or I can remember places we've been, and I'm good with directions. But like, when anything memorized, oh no, that those items are long since replaced by other flashes.
That just makes you a digital native, Dave, because in a Google Brain world, we can't even remember phone numbers anymore. We don't even bother. Program it in once.
There's some truth in that. So one of my undergraduate degrees is in English, in which I memorized, whole passages from plays and, the first several books of Paradise Lost and that sort of thing. But then I discovered that in order to actually pass exams in English, I needed to have enough knowledge to get things done. And then when I switched to political science, discovered I need to know how to find things. I don't have to memorize anything. I just know I need to know where to find it. And I think that has served me well over the years.
I'm 100% with you. I've always been I need to know where to find things, not a must have it at instant recall. And I've always leveraged that, and then Google's made me
Although,
ridiculous.
I will say, I'm not sure if it is productive for me at all, but I still do remember every single word to every single song on the Joshua Tree album, just because if you put it to music, it'll stick in my brain forever. Well, if you don't put it to music,
there's also, depending on your age when music comes out, you may have so much activity going on in your brain that literally just digs those connections so deep that they will be there forever.
That's true. There are probably a couple of songs. And then the other thing is that, and I will say this with a smile, like, I don't think I could do it instantly, but I can definitely recite all of Star Trek II, the movie, along with it. Like the whole film.
I'm probably that way with Monty Python's Holy Grail, because we had an album of the soundtrack of Monty Python and the Holy Grail when I was a kid. So it was literally the soundtrack of that movie from start to finish. And
I don't think those count quite the same way as mine.
Not like the Gettysburg Address.
No. Well, gents, we're brought to you today by our friends at PCmatic. Endpoint security built on a zero trust default deny foundation. Finally, a lightweight, simple to deploy, and easy to manage approach to application allow listing. The perfect complement to your current security stack. No minimum and no annual contracts. Find out more by visiting PCmatic.com/MSP today.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And let me tee up our first topic today, an article that we are pointing to from our friends over at the New York Times, talking about moderators on social media platforms. It's worth a read. It's actually very interesting analysis of it. But the central question that they are talking about is, by the way, on Reddit, on Facebook, on these other popular platforms, if there is a moderator who kind of maintains the peace and keeps things on topic, that human is almost always an individual. So the question is asked, A, is that the right way to moderate content on these platforms? And B, do you think those humans deserve a little hazard pay because of the stuff that they generally encounter? So from your perspective, guys, I'd love to know, what do you think about A, the current approach, the model for moderation right now, and how could we actually improve on that?
One of the interesting numbers here is that they estimate that if you were to have to actually pay these folks, it would collectively be about $3.4 million worth of unpaid labor on Reddit, which is 3% of one estimate of Reddit's revenue from advertising in 2019. I have to say, I think these people probably get some points in heaven. But if you added money to the equation, I think you'd have some people drop out because they are contributors to a community, not people who are doing this so that they can get rich. They are building reputations, and they are building an audience, and they are feeling good about themselves for giving, and they're feeling good about themselves for being recognized. I would love to talk to a psychologist about what would happen if you dropped a dollar in there and see how many people just simply disappeared.
The answer for me, it's that it's such a complicated issue on the intention of the community. And so I'm going to use sort of two extremes on this. Like on one extreme, like if the community is absolutely a corporate entity which is designed to drive revenue, like it's a customer service community kind of thing, it's like, oh yeah, that's paid. That is very clearly a paid engagement that organization better be investing in with staff. But you can immediately go to, well, there's degrees of that, right? You do want to reward power users at some level, and you may give them kind of other benefits. But then you can go all the way out to, there are things that are purely community driven for the love of the thing, and building community is its own value. And I'm not sure I don't believe that should be paid. Now, what I do think is done is that we're looking at compensation through a lens of just money, and there are other ways to reward community leadership that are not necessarily writing checks. They could have access to better tools. They could have access to more information. They could get earlier access to things. There's all kinds of other things that you can pay, and I'm putting pay in big quotes, your most loyal fans, for example, without it necessarily being purely compensated from a monetary perspective. I think the question is kind of wrong, and that we're trying to solve it with one answer. Should moderators be paid? Yes or no? It's like, well, that isn't the right question necessarily. It's what kind of moderators, what situations, what tools do they need? What are the models of compensation? And it is way wider than just saying they should all be paid or not.
See, and I will go to the other extreme of the argument. I recognize that concept of community and volunteerism, and as professionals, all of us participate in various communities where you sit on boards or you participate in activities that are not compensated because you are passionate about the activity, and I buy that. But I don't buy that any of these platforms are not commercial entities, and I think that it is a cost of doing business in a responsible environment to actually ensure that the product you send out into the world is not poisonous to the world. I mean, some people might want to wake up tomorrow and go, you know what I'd like to do? I'd like to open a meat processing plant, and I'd like to make the world's best bacon and pork chops and send it out there into the world. And you would be completely free to do that, as long as you actually pay for that moderator to come in and ensure that there is safety in all of your operations. That's not negotiable. It baffles me that we've arrived at a point where all these platforms say, well, it's just too expensive. I just can't do it. Well, then the answer is, well, then you don't get to be a platform in our world if you can't afford to moderate yourself.
Let me make a last sort of point to this, because I think the other thing we didn't even get into it was the other lens of this is, does the platform monetize based on advertising, or is the platform simply exist for the sake of the community? And those are also another lens that's different. If there's another group that's monetizing the effort by attaching ads to it, that is different than a community that exists for its own sake, that is not monetized by another person, that simply is, that can be a very different thing.
Well, and totally. You know, at the end of the day, people do things for different reasons. And the reason that I participate a certain way on Reddit is different than how I participate on Facebook, and I have different reasons for doing so. So do the moderators, right? And, you know, we have figured out ways to reward people who do things like in Yelp, you know, they will have parties for their biggest contributors and all of that. So there are lots of different ways to do it. But at the end of the day, I think those who choose to do it so that they can give back, money is not going to make any difference.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to move us into topic two, because we could go forever there, but we are on time,
we
gents.
Forever on anything.
And this is also true. I'm going to point is this: we're leveraging a Washington Post article here with a headline of "Hacking Russia Was Off Limits. The Ukraine War Made It a Free for All." The discussion is around the fact that for the better part of sort of a decade now, the general thinking had been that, well, Russia is kind of the safe haven for these hackers, but attacking back is problematic, and thus they have been off limits. Of course, now the war in Ukraine has really just opened that all up, and now outbound and inbound hacking across that line is just happening, and the counterinsurgents is definitely pushing back into Russia and wreaking havoc both online. The question, though, is this good, or is this just one more step towards complete bedlam?
Well, you know, it's interesting to me that it's almost the same as the Russian army, in that there was this assumption that you do not want to mess with the country that is funding all of this outbound evil activity. But it turns out that they have insecure passwords, and they don't have a lot of stuff encrypted, and like, they are as weak as anybody, and they've sort of made an enemy for themselves. I do think it's a very scary time. It's a time where we should all be quite concerned about how Russia is going to react to being a victim and what this will mean going forward. But it's an area where it's almost like it's more of a Wild West than anything on the internet is. The activity going on with I want to say spy versus spy, but it's like hacker versus hacker inside the Russian so-called republic.
See, and I think this is a classic case of bully psychology. There's just a baseline reality that says, oh, you don't want to tell that guy no, even if what he's doing is bad and unacceptable, because you fear what the potential escalated consequences would be. Well, that's exactly how bullies keep taking away kids' school lunch money from the dawn of time. It's not an acceptable model. And so my reaction as I read through this article, I learned a phrase from a television commercial for a taco shell product several years ago. Is it bedlam or is it justified? ¿Por qué no los dos? Why can we not have both? In other words, yeah, it's what you get when you're the one out there initiating the problems. You get what you give, and you deserve to get that back. But to Carl's point, it is causing an escalation that I don't think any of us understands what the end game is. There's one scenario that I was reading recently where the answer is it's all the emperor's clothes, and they've been holding us at bay with the fear of their kickback. And in the end, it might just legitimately turn out to be like, they don't actually have that much power to come back, and it was really not a bad situation. Or it could be the other scenario, and that one doesn't have good outcome.
It's funny, because when I throw out the question, right, and I throw it out the way it is, I present it as an or, right? Like, is this good, or is this another step toward bedlam? And my answer is yes. Right? And actually, what I mean by this is yes, it is distinctly a step towards more chaos.
Well, one of the alarming stats in this article we're pointing to, so it says, so in April, the number of presumed Russian credentials, that's those ending in a .ru, jumped to encompass 50% of the global total of compromised credentials. That's pretty impressive, right? And right, more than five times as many as in January. So it is literally like Russia hasn't been the victim before, and they're not sure how to react, except to just as with their military, do what they can, and they're bigger and they have more money in the long run, so they assume they're going to prevail.
Well, and thus why I'm able to say, is this good? Yes, because we need it to get worse, I think, for it to get better. Because what we had had prior was an imbalance, right? We have the attackers coming out of Russia feeling where they were protected because their hosts were just going, oh, this is great. It's all upside, no downside. Now there is downside for essentially all the players. You might be able to make an argument that China still doesn't have a downside in the same way, but let's focus here on Russia. Now in this conflict, everyone has downside. Everyone is both, you know, attacking and being attacked. This has always been the theory of, nuclear standoff is the same way as mutual self-destruction. We're moving towards that, but if everyone has the same risks, it's far easier to come to a place of compromise and at least of quiet, uneasy peace when you all have the same risks.
So here's the next question. If you take a cynical view of foreign relations and say it's better for us to muck things up overseas so that they won't attack us personally, can we also say the same thing with this? Let the Russians fight the Russians. Let them keep it all inside their country, trying to destroy each other's networks, and maybe we'll have less of that going on towards the United States. Or
maybe. I'm not convinced that'll happen.
Or in an era of computers, does it just not make any difference? It can't expand.
Yeah, but I go back to it is my fallback measurement, but it works, is I look at financial motivations here, and I go, attacking one another on this, if I'm looking at it from a financial outcomes, is like, that's not good for them. But because they're going to want to mine for this to be a profitable enterprise, that is attacking generally Western targets. And so more now there's just a higher cost to doing it. And thus, I think it'll get a little bit more off balance and they'll be less inclined to do it.
Well, and that's the thing, is that we all learned in 1960s United States television programming that the best way to deal with a bully is to punch him back, hit him in the nose, and see what happens. Now, on a geopolitical scale, that could really have bad consequences, and it could be terrible advice. But I do agree with you, Dave. If you don't think there are any consequences for bad behavior, then it's just philosophical whether or not you choose not to do that bad behavior. But once you realize direct and tangible consequences, you're going to think twice next time before you do it. So yes, I think it's a good development. And also, yes, it's going to get ugly in the near future.
On a lighter note, Russia finally found somebody who will take payment in rubles.
They found somebody. Good for that.
Now they need their own, like, Russian Dogecoin. All right, let's move on to topic number three, which, oddly enough, is also involving Russia. So some people may or may not know that there is an organization called Yandex, Y-A-N-D-E-X, which is sort of the global competitor to Google. Yandex started out as sort of, hey, we're going to do some hosting, we're going to do some search. They've taken over 60% of the search in Russia. And then they said, hey, you know, we're a big tech company. We can do it all. So they do taxi apps. It used to be that the taxi service in Russia was a disaster until these guys partnered with Uber, who couldn't get a foothold in Russia. And then they do email. They provide Grubhub robot food delivery at the Ohio State University, and had plans to go to 250 campuses. But sadly now, one change by the government of Russia has basically destroyed Yandex's future. And that change is they have to have their news filtered through the Russian government. And so their five top headlines per the day, which was their key feature of their search site, has all become whatever the Kremlin wants them to say. And so people are leaving in droves. Programmers are abandoning the organization. Their percentage of the markets in various areas has diminished dramatically. And their ability to expand around the world has been dramatically hit. So it's sort of like, this is our one hope for a truly modern Russian tech company seems to have faded. What say you?
An authoritarian? Break all of the bits that work? I'm shocked. Shocked, I say. I mean, it's like, from a personal level, like, I certainly don't ever want to wish harm on people that are just trying to, you know, build something, or the employees of this. Like, that's not the angle on this. It's the, look, this is what happens. This is what happens when, with war, it's very destructive in all kinds of second order effect ways. This is the consequence that the leadership in Russia is imposing on their people. There isn't a solid argument to be made of, look, the people, if they want this stuff to work, they're going to have to push back on the forces that are causing that disruption. You can see, and that's where revolutions happen, right? Is because you've taken away the solid base that they're looking to build from. This is not a story I want to cheer, right? I'm definitely not happy to see this kind of thing happen, but this is what happens. And you know, capitalism is a broken system, but it's the best of a bunch of bad ones. And you got authoritarianism, and well, this is what happens, right? And we've got versions over in China too. Anybody seen Jack Ma recently? Didn't think so. Right? Like, this, that's how this stuff falls out in authoritarian regimes.
See, and I would agree with that, Dave. I think on an institutional level, on an economic level, and an individual level, this is both unbelievable and terribly disappointing, right? When I look at it from an industrial point of view, this has historically been a very keen success story. They've not just aggregated a tremendous amount of traffic and audience and provided some ancillary services, as you said, Carl, they did it well. Right? Like, this has been a generally well-received success story. This was a company that came from nothing, that emulated a foreign business model, applied their own spin to it, aggregated relevant services, and did well with that thing. Now, I've done business around the world, and whenever we work in different territories, different zones, the Russian territory has been the fastest growing revenue contributor contributor, globally speaking, for most significant IT vendors for 10 or 12 of the past 15 years, right? It has been a radical growth story, and it has been extremely beneficial to them culturally, economically, as well as kind of geopolitically, right? It brought them into the club of nations, and we thought that it was going to cause them to behave well in order to continue to get the benefits of that. But I will say, I know way too many good technology professionals in Russia who, whether they worked here at this company or at other companies that we've worked with over the years, brilliant technologists, motivated entrepreneurs, very capable professionals who are getting squooshed for no reason of their own. Now, we live in a world where a lot of fortunes are turning, right? Where the VC valuations for Silicon Valley companies are cratering to a realistic level, where cryptocurrencies are cratering to realistic levels. And I would argue those are proper market corrections because they were false values that were never justified. This one is completely different. This was a good company that got squooshed for not any of their own bad decisions.
And just one stat from the article, that the value of Yandex went from about 31 billion to 7 billion. Most of us could figure out how to, you know, prop up a company on 7 billion and make it go again. But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, what you sort of alluded to there, Ryan, is our belief from whatever, 15, 20 years ago, that we have a flat earth, right? And that the more we prop up other countries by propping up their technology, by outsourcing to those countries, the more we all become intertwined, and then they don't have any choice to all become representative democracies. I so bought into that. I can't tell you. 15 years ago, I bought that hook, line, and sinker, and have been outsourcing to other countries ever since, and dramatically increased my travel because I believe that it really eventually that play will work. But today, as Dave pointed out, it's not working in China. It's not working in Russia. But I think in the long term, it will. At some point, Putin is necessary. Xi is necessary so that those countries can say, man, we dodged a bullet. Let's not go do that anymore.
I would agree. And the takeaway that I have from this is, again, don't stop and think, you know, good guys, bad guys. I am the unintentional source of old-timey cultural references today, but I remember the song that Sting once sang, I hope the Russians love their children too. I hope the Russian government loves their economy too, because I swear it's not their fault that it's going wrong. It's not like this was a bad business, and we know plenty of those in the tech space where we have complained about them domestically and internationally over the years. There's plenty of them that I think are bad actors, not these guys. And so that's where I come back to, boy, it'd be nice if we could use commerce as the international currency, but maybe it's a little too craven to be successful in this situation.
It depends, because if your point there is it's why I do tend to think that any quote-unquote conflicts with China would tend to be more economic and technology versus it going to full-on conflict, because the two economies are far more linked, and the Chinese government recognizes that. And I think this is one case where the difference here is the Russian government doesn't care about its links to its European neighbors and has decided to bully its way through it, thinking it won't matter. They're being proven wrong. That don't think that the Chinese aren't watching that and saying, ah, we see. And while I do predict some level of conflict there, it will be technology and economically driven, not guns and tanks.
The sad news is that from our perspective, from the U.S. perspective, we just have to watch and sort of get a handle on how complicated this is and how much it will affect what we do. Because the displacement of so many really smart technical people by the thousands continues, and every time there's a new bump in this story, it involves thousands and thousands of highly technical people deciding, you know, the minute I can get out of this country, I'm going to. And some of that is good. Some of it is simply giving us, you know, some of the warm bodies we need because we have millions of people shortage in especially cybersecurity. But it also means some of these people are just going to take their bad practices and their evil habits and say, oh, I'll just move my center of operations somewhere else. So both of those things affect us. And, you know, volatility is always something that affects markets. And that's certainly going to be the case for us and for our industry for a long time to come.
Yeah. And as you say, Carl, whether you were outsourcing in small bits or very, very large engagements, both Ukraine and Russia have been exceptional growth markets for offshoring in technical fields, tremendous capabilities in technical expanse, right? Like really large numbers of really advanced technical skills. And both of those are really not viable right now, which only makes the recruiting problem over here that much more difficult.
Sadly, that will do it for this week's show. I do want to remind people on a positive note, you're an economy of one, so don't let, you know, this get you down. Go out and
that
do
so true.
You can do in your business. So, and that will do it for episode 172 of the Killing It podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.